I'm Jordan Abel, Director of Public Programs at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco, and I welcome you to BINA, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the JCCSF. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of BINA, our guest is chef, restaurateur, and cookbook author Lydia Bastianich. She's joined in conversation by Delfina chef and co-owner Craig Stahl. And now, join Barbara Lane on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Lydia Bastianich and Craig Stahl.
Lydia Bastianich is a very busy woman, an Emmy Award-winning public television host, and a best-selling cookbook author. She's the chef owner of four acclaimed New York City restaurants, Flidia, Becco, Esca, and Del Posto, as well as Lydia's Pittsburgh and Lydia's Kansas City, along with her daughter, Tanya. Lydia is founder and president of Tavola Productions, an entertainment company that produces high-quality broadcast productions. And she has a line of pastas and all-natural sauces called Lydia's. Along with her son, Joe Bastianich, Mario Botali, and Oscar Farinetti, she opened Italy, the largest artisanal Italian food and wine marketplace in New York City, Chicago, and Sao Paulo, Brazil. And some of us are praying for Italy, San Francisco, right? Lydia taught me to add the rind of the cheese to the broth for my soup, and I'm eternally grateful to her for that. She appears in conversation tonight with Craig Stahl, co-owner of one of my favorite San Francisco restaurants, Delfina. Please welcome Lydia Bastianich and Craig Stahl to the JCCSF.
So it's nice to be here in this capacity. I've been a preschool parent here, and I've been to a lot of soccer awards and potlucks, but I've never gotten to do this. So welcome to San Francisco.
Well, thank you for being here.
And you're known as America's Nona, which I just thought that was amazing.
Great title.
So I have to start by asking, what was it like to cook for the Pope? I know you cooked for Pope Francis when he visited New York City this past September, and you and your team were in charge of breakfast, lunch, and dinner.
It was, yeah. Pope Francis was in New York 40 hours, and we had two breakfasts, one lunch, and two dinners to do for him.
Is he a picky eater?
No, he's not.
No.
He's not. Well, you know, when they first asked me, now I cooked 8 years ago for Pope Benedict as well. So this was, you know, I mean, yeah, it doesn't get any better than that, you know, two popes, but sometimes I wonder. But, you know, when first they asked me, you think, okay, what am I going to do? How can I please this man? And Argentina, I had visions of big pieces of meat, you know, rib roast,
maybe.
You know, I'm going to bring it all out, roll it, cut it, you know. And then, of course, Vatican says, no, he's very simple. He wants to eat very light. And I think he's watching. I think there's, you know,
his
health is.
And
so then I reverted to, you know, well, what is he? He is Italian. His grandparents are from Piemonte. So the cuisine of Piemonte.
White truffles?
No, he's much too humble to have white truffles. I didn't go there. But I made risotto, though. Risotto with mushrooms. And I made a good chicken capon stock, actually, and served twice. One of the days was Friday, so fish. I had some fishermen from Long Island get some great striped, and I did a roasted bass with oil, parsley, and some squash from my garden. You know, now this was in late September, so I still had my garden going, and my mother, 95. She loves her garden. And so we went to harvest for him, and she was so proud. We had string beans, we had squash, basil and parsley, and we had some leeks. And I brought that in. And so it was rather simple. Breakfast, 6:45. It was at 7. He was up at 6:45. You know, Craig, the Pope doesn't stay in hotels or eats in restaurants. There's kind of the Vatican's ambassador's house, which is on 72nd between Fifth Avenue and Madison. And it is like a double brownstone. And so in that house, you come in, there's the entrance, and then in the back, there's the kitchen. The first floor up, there's the living room in the front and the dining room in the back. And the next floor up is that where he slept. So he had his bedroom, he had his chapel. And so it was like, you know, in-house. You were in-house with him, like family.
That's incredible. Is it true that he came back to hang out in the kitchen and drink espresso with you?
He did.
That's amazing.
You know, he was very... With Pope Benedict, we had big meals. I think one of the dinners was 55 cardinals. And, you know, he was conducting business. But Pope Francis was very, very low-key. He only had his kind of confidants with him, his doctor, the Secret Serviceman. And every meal was about 12 or 14 people. So it was very, very kind of... And one of the afternoon, the Friday afternoon after lunch... We were quick in serving him. He had an opportunity to take a little nap, and after the nap, the Secret Service ran in the kitchen. The Pope is coming. You know, in between meals, we were planning sort of what we were going to do and relaxing and having our coffee. So he walks in and he posso prendere un caffè con voi? May I have a coffee with you? I mean, you can imagine the Pope.
Certo, right?
Sì, certamente. And my daughter Tanya, who was there with her, she just ran so fast. They got hooked on a door handle. Ripped the thing off, but she kept on going. It was funny.
He takes sugar, right?
Hmm?
He takes sugar with
it? No, nothing. True. Nothing.
Okay. So I don't know how many people here tonight know your history, but and please correct me if I get something wrong, but I'm going to blow through this really quickly because I have questions to ask about it. But you're originally you're born in Istria, which was part of Yugoslavia when you were born, and it was...
Well, I was born... February 21st, 1947. The Paris Treaty, which was the treaty after World War II that sort of divided, mm-hmm. was on February 25th or 6th on 1947. So I was, you know, when I was born, actually the Allies were governing that part of Italy. What was Italy? So, you know, I was meant to be an American, I guess. but yeah, that's the part. Istria, if you look at Italy, northeast corner, there's a little peninsula there, and that part was Italy into Dalmatia. And after World War II, Italy lost it to the new formed communist Yugoslavia. So that's when it went over, and we were kind of caught behind the Iron Curtain.
And then you your family wanted to immigrate to Italy.
Well, yeah, because, but, you know, we were ethnic Italian. My mother was an elementary school teacher, an Italian school teacher. And once communism had set in, now I was just born, so I was kind of, you know, between the home, which was Italian, and grandparents, and the regime, which you know, was communist, and you had to speak Yugoslavian at the time. Now, whenever you're on a border in Europe, and you know that, you speak more than one language. So the language wasn't all that much of a problem.
You were bilingual as a child.
Exactly. But you know, we couldn't speak Italian, though. We couldn't speak under a Yugoslavian rule. We couldn't go to church. We couldn't do any of that. And so my parents decided that ultimately, when I was 9, that they would literally escape back into Italy.
So you were in a camp near...
Well, the trip back to Italy, since we had relatives in Trieste, in Italy on the other side, My mother, my brother, and I went as tourists. They wouldn't allow the whole family. My father had to remain behind. And we went to visit our great aunt. And my father, after 2 weeks, literally escaped. He did escape over the border. He was shot at. He made it, and he joined us in Trieste. And then at that point, we were Italians. We could have stayed in Italy. But it was difficult. There was jobs were hard to find. You know, living, being part of another family, my parents, I guess, felt a little bit, they said, we need to move on and give these children an opportunity. And the opportunity was that we could have gone to a refugee, political refugee camp, which they chose to do that. And it was called San Saba. It's still there now, a museum. And we stayed there for 2 years awaiting an opportunity to migrate. And in 1958, Dwight Eisenhower was the president, and he opened the immigration, the first immigration after the war, for people fleeing communism, and we were one of that family. And so in 1958, we came to the United States.
You almost went to Australia.
There was an option. And then my parents said, well, let's hold off. Australia is so far. And
but so you opened your first restaurant in Queens with your husband Felice in 1971.
Right.
And then a second spot in 1977. And then you sold both of those to open Felidia.
Right.
What was the scene like in 1971 in the 70s in Queens? And it was before Italy had regions, I think.
Exactly.
Right? I think.
Yeah, before they were known. In 1971, I certainly was not a chef. I was young. I loved cooking. Now, those formative years with my grandmother were very instrumental in my passion for food. She had this setting where we had all the courtyard animals and goats, and we milked the goats and ducks and pigs. Every November, we slaughtered the pigs, made the prosciutto, the sausages. We made our own olive oil. My grandfather made the wine and the garden. That's how a family was fed. So I grew up in that setting, just kind of assisting grandma in all of those things. And really, with her making the bread, the communal oven, bread was made twice a week. And you helped grandma, she would have me knead. She would put a little stool for me and get in there and knead the bread. And so I got into food. And then when we moved into Italy and on into the world, I didn't know that as kids that we were going to not go back. And I think that, I didn't say goodbye to my grandmother or my friends. And I think that there was this nostalgia that I left behind. And I think that food filled that kind of connection. And from then on in Italy, and when I came to the States as a young person also, I loved cooking. I loved making the foods that I remember, and the smells and all of that brought me back to that courtyard, to grandma. And, food for me became emotional, became a way of communicating. And I just, got into it after. Although going here to high school and college, this is not what I thought I was going to be. But then I met my husband, who was in the industry. And he was the front of the house, as we call it. And he wanted to open his little restaurant, looking for a partner. You know how things go. And the partners didn't agree. So I said, you know what? I'll help you. And in 71, we opened, it was a 9-table. It was a 30-seater restaurant. And he was in front, and we hired a chef, because I wasn't a chef. But it was an Italian-American chef, the Italian-American food. And I became his sous chef. And for 10 years, I worked with him in the kitchen at Buona Via, was the restaurant, and really kind of honed in the skills of running a restaurant kitchen. And I learned along the way the Italian-American cuisine, which, I love. It's a great cuisine.
Were there some dishes, some classic, what was on the menu back then?
Well, it was veal parmigiana, eggplant parmigiana, was manicotti, was the bracciola. And a lot of these things I didn't recognize. Because also the Italian-American cuisine, you know, the first influx of Italian immigrants came at the end of the 1800s, and they came basically from three regions. That was Calabria, Campania, Naples, and Sicily. Right. So the Italian-American cuisine is rooted in those three regions. And at my age, I had not visited those regions. And so that food, for me, was really, it was delicious. I still love that food, but I really got to know it for 10 years with him. But Craig, what I did in between then, when I began to feel comfortable, I began inserting the regional food like ghiotta, like polenta, like risotto.
And people warmed up to that.
They really did. And then when we sold both and we opened Felidia in 81, and I became the chef, that's when I really did. I said, you know, I'm going to cook what we eat at home. And that was the regional Italian cuisine.
My parents loved Felidia. They lived there and would tell me about it all the time. So this is your ninth cookbook?
I would Tenth.
Say. Tenth cookbook. You've also written two children's books.
Three.
So what makes this cookbook different than the others? What do you want to say with this cookbook? What's the
focus?
Well,
this book is one of those books, you know, that kind of you wait until you're ready for something, until you have sort of all the stars are aligned. This is one of those books that you have a drawer or a file in the computer, and you put everything in there, and you say, one of these days.
A virtual file.
Yes, okay. Yes. And I pulled it all out about 3 years ago, and I felt, you know, prior to this, with all those books, I mean, I did the Italian-American cookbook, I did the regional Italian cookbook, I did favorites, you know, pasta and so on. So I really covered the territory. But this book is different. It took me 3 years to pull this together, and my daughter Tanya really worked with me on it. And it's about, it's more than 400 recipes. And it's a lot about understanding food. There's no pictures because I would like this to be kind of a reference book to remain in the kitchen and transcend sort of generations. And it has basic Italian recipes, or it has Italian American recipes. It has recipes that sort of are a bit innovative because, you know, cuisine always evolves. But what it has pieces of my story all over. It has what I deem very important is, you know, understanding food, understanding how to buy it, understanding how to save it, how to store it, understanding the techniques. You know, is this piece of meat best seared, braised, grilled, steamed? You know, so I go through all the techniques, and it's a way of the recipe is great, but all these little pieces of information makes you kind of an independent cook in the kitchen. And, you know, I all the things that I've accumulated through the years, I put it very simply in this book, hoping to really be kind of a mentor in the kitchens of whoever.
I think that's your role now.
Yeah.
Yeah. Different subject. Do women cooks, do women chefs cook differently than men?
Yes.
Are you in the kitchen at Del Posto and do you butt heads with Mario and Mark? Is there any ego going on? I know men might have a little more ego in the kitchen than women, I'm not sure, but how does that work?
A lot of negotiations. I think, you know, they really respect me, and I think I respect, I respect innovation, new ideas, and it's all needed. You know, the cuisine, as everything else, is moving forward. You know, what I bring to the table is a lot of stability, a lot of years of experience. I bring tradition to the table. So I think, because that's what I feel my role. My role is not to invent new Italian recipes. My role is to be a conduit for the Italian culture. And you know, and that goes back to what I told you before. You know, I'm born Italian, and I'm very American. And so I'm blessed with two of the best cultures in the world. You couldn't get any better than that. But I'm always trying to pull them together, you know, like my life. And so I feel my role is really to respect the Italian culinary tradition and to, you know, innovate it as much as is necessary. On the other hand, young chefs today, you know, need that spirit of innovation. They need to. It's so competitive out there, and you know that, and so I appreciate that. So it's kind of a combination, you know. You work, we talk, we discuss, and I let them taste and let them know, and then they come up with their own, because each restaurant, and you have multiple restaurants, it's a combination. It's a combination of who I am, my philosophy, and of who the chef is, and his philosophy or her philosophy.
You're listening to chef, restaurateur, and cookbook author Lydia Bastianich, whose book is Lydia's Mastering the Art of Italian Cuisine, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Great Italian Cook. She's joined in conversation by Delfina chef and co-owner Craig Stahl, on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
Can you talk a little more about authenticity? Because it's something where, you know, you see Italian chefs playing with things and innovating and coming up with ideas. And sometimes when American chefs do that, they're criticized. It's not authentic and it's not, you know, traditional. And it's how do you feel your restaurants have evolved with you know, taking the traditional and
well, you know,
keeping it current and moving it ahead?
Food is like history. You know, it really reflects the story of the people that eat it and cook it. It reflects the topography. It reflects the climate. It reflects the different occupations that came and went. And it's amazing because you could tell a story with the recipes, at least, you know, certainly in Italy, where we come from, Northeast. The borders that we were talking about before, you know, Germanic influence. That area was under the Hungarian Empire for about 80 years. So for me, to cook strudel, to cook spätzle, to make Sachertorte is not a problem. Because, you know, I come, for me, to cook with sauerkraut is not a problem. I get the Slavic, but yet it's the Italian base. And that's that whole area. You go down to Sicily, you know, Sicily, couscous, Moorish, Arab influence, and all of that. Pasta, I think, you know, first came through to Italy, through Sicily, and it's called Itria. And I think the story goes that, you know, the nomads of North Africa, as they traveled, they would make this paste with wheat and water and make this flatbread sort of, let it dry on rocks, and then put it in their sack and went on to the next.
That wasn't matzah?
No,
he would say.
and somehow in the transition over to Sicily and all that, but they took that dry dough, broke it in pieces, reconstituted it in boiling water, and you got pasta. And so on. So, you know, it's amazing food. It's wonderful food. So authenticity in food and me kind of feeling really responsible for transferring the culture of Italy, I give a lot of thought to that. And my somewhat deductions are that you need basically two things in transporting a culinary culture. You need traditional ingredients and you need the techniques. Those two put together, you can. When I started in 1971 in Forest Hills, there was no short grain rice. There was no arborio, no canaroli. So
how prosciutto.
No prosciutto. No grana padana. No cheese. No San Marzano tomato. The oils were scarce as far as oils. So how can you make a risotto, traditionale risotto, if you don't have the short grain rice?
What did you do?
Well, my father insisted on risotto. He loved it. We used to make it with Uncle Ben's. And
wow.
But every time we made it, my mother made it, he would complain. And then he would ask for it again. And then finally, I think we got the arborio rice and the cannaroli began to come in 75 or 76. So in those years, you know, what you would do, you supplement the technique. You would use a lot of the technique rather than the ingredients to make. But ingredients plus technique really transporting. And now in America we have, you can have just about any authentic Italian ingredient. And, I mean, you know, you're not Italian, and you're transporting the Italian culture, and you're doing a great job at it.
Thank you. So. I love what you say in your book about risotto, and speaking of risotto, and not pumping it full of butter and using, you know, technique to make it creamy and to emulsify the rice and to get that texture rather than... You're talking about chefs whipping butter and folding
right.
that
well,
in.
Right. Well, the easiest way is, you know, you just...
But it's not a vehicle for butter and cheese.
No. The idea... It enhances at the end, but an idea is to pull out the starches out of the rice kernel. And now there's more than 1,200 different species of rice. And again, rice really took hold in Italy. It came through Sicily in about the 700s, really took hold up in near Milano in the 1200s because there's the Po Valley, rice and bowl. So it was ideal. And the Italians perfected the short grain rice. So a short grain rice, the difference is that it has, because rice, once it's milled, it's about 95% starch. And the ratio of the different starches is what gives the character to the rice. And in a short grain rice, there is basically two starches, the amylopectin, which is the short, and the amylose, the long. The ratio of the two is that there's much more short-chain starches. Therefore, when you cook it properly, that's why the addition of a little bit of stock. And then you pull out those starch and stir it. And you continue to do that. And you have to do that the kernel remains nice and whole and al dente, but the starch seep out, and that gives the creaminess.
So, you've got a chef interviewing Lidia Bastianich, so we're going to talk about food for a minute. Can we talk about polenta for a second? Because when you ate at Delfina, I don't know, it must have been 15 years ago, you came in.
I came after, but I came at the very opening when you and your wife were running around and working so hard. It was delicious.
You enjoyed your meal, but you know, I saw your plate when it came back to the kitchen, and you didn't eat your polenta. So
16 years later.
We chefs remember these things. This is your wine, by the way. I prefer. Anyway, you know, I was reading your new book, and I was reading my favorite book of yours. One of my favorite books, period, is your first book.
That's my first
book. And I was reading the difference in you know, you're talking about polenta, and yeah, there were some things. One recipe has bay leaf, one recipe has cheese, one doesn't, one has oil, one has butter, one you put the cornmeal together with the water before boiling, another one you do it after boiling. There's a million ways to do it, but I've been dying to talk to you about polenta for 15 years.
I'm going to come back. I'm going to have a plate of polenta at your place.
I hope we honor it. So.
Well, polenta, you know, it's one of the new world products, you know, like tomato is. So you'd think, you know, Italy, tomato sauce. But it's only after the discovery of the new world that tomatoes, potatoes, peppers, and polenta came to Italy. And in that area, northeast, that was after, after World War I, there was a lot of famine. And polenta... is a great product because it doesn't need that much space and it yields a lot. So during that famine after World War I, they started growing polenta in that region, and it saved a lot of lives and families. So that whole region became devoted to polenta, growing polenta. And now if you go through Friuli, you see fields and fields of polenta for the making of polenta. And, you know, as the Tuscans are called mangia fagioli because they eat a lot of beans.
Bean eaters.
Yeah, bean eaters. We are called polentoni. So polenta eaters. And polenta for us is more common than pasta, actually.
Hopefully we'll be known as a polentone type restaurant in the future. So this is one of my favorite books that I own, and you know I was reading through it yesterday when in preparation for this. And
well, I'll tell you the story of that book, and you know once we opened, because a lot of people ask me, you know, Lydia, you know, you did so much. How did it all happen? Well, I certainly didn't have a plan. I'm going to do this, and I'm going to do 10 books, and I'm going to do 6 restaurants. It's, you know, along the way, the opportunities came. And when we opened Falidia in 81, you know, journalists started coming. Julia Child was there. James Beard came with her, and so on. And so Jay Jacobs, who at that time wrote for Gourmet, he wrote a beautiful article on Lydia and on myself and interviewed me. And then he came and said, Lydia, you know, you should write a book, cookbook. I says, but I'm not an author. And so he said, well, let's do it together. And that was my first book with Jay Jacobs. We did it together with Doubleday. And kind of it opened the road for me in cookbook writing. He kind of gave me the comfort and the way. And since, I mean, I was blessed because I went with Knopf, and my editor was Judith Jones, who was the editor for Julia Child as well. Uh-huh. So it was, I mean, she just retired last year, but was I mean, I just enjoy it. It seems that, you know, I love to teach, I love to share, and a book is just one way of doing that. And I'll go, you want to know my TV story?
Yes.
Okay. So
first,
Julia,
I want you to sign my book.
Okay.
I brought this here. I've been waiting all this time.
Listen, he has a list for me. Gotta eat my polenta. Gotta sign his book.
To my favorite chef. To my favorite.
So I'm going to just say, with love, Lydia.
Perfect.
Okay. Is that good enough?
Yeah. But this book, I look through it and I see so much of our cooking was, you know, influenced by this. And,
love
and
it.
I have we have a duck and sauerkraut that you probably wouldn't recognize as being influenced by the book, but it
that's,
is.
That's the kind of that area, that mixed area.
But how did you get into TV?
Well, Julia, and so she came to the restaurant. She came a few times, and she loved the risotto, and she wanted me to teach her to make the risotto. So she came over the house, and we kind of, you know, became friends. And then she ultimately asked me to be on her show, the MasterChef series, and we did 2 episodes, and the producer said, you know, Lydia, you're pretty good on television. How about your own show? And This is how I got into it. So, you know, our business is a great place to be. You get so many opportunities along the way. So, you know, it's all of these things that I've done along the way were opportunities that came, and I thought that I might enjoy doing them, and I took the opportunity.
And you have 3 different series?
I have one. Every year I do 26 half-hour episodes, and usually they go with the book. So it's Lydia's Kitchen, and what you're seeing now is with the new book that's out. But in addition to that, I did with WGBH, which is the station, PBS station. Now, when the producer asked me to have my show, there were 2 things that I asked for. One, that I be on PBS, because I feel that's a platform that I would like to be, and that it reaches out, you know. There. And the other one was that we do the show from my house, Now, I did that because I was afraid of the studio. I says, I'm going to go in the studio. I don't know anything about the studio. My house, my kitchen, I know my stove and everything. And so for more than 12 years, we did the shows from my kitchen at home in there.
Can you tell us about Italy? And what is the vision for Italy? It's a super ultra Italian department store of food. I've been to the one in New York. I've been to the one in Rome. I hear there's one in LA coming soon.
2017 we're planning.
Evidently, right. San Francisco's overlooked. But but
one at a time.
But it's incredible. It's an amazing experience
well,
to walk
you
through.
Know, That was, and you know, you travel to Italy a lot. I go to Italy all the time because I love it, because I have family, but also because you need to kind of update yourself. You need to see what's happening. So I had heard that this Italy concept had opened in Torino, and Oscar Farinetti, who I didn't know at the time, was kind of the brainchild behind it. And so I made it a point to go to visit. I made an appointment with him. I wanted to meet. I wanted to know what this is all about and to see what is this phenomenon. I wasn't thinking of America then. I was curious. I wanted to see all these products. What does he have? And we met. We had dinner. He asked me to do two events. I went back twice to do events at Italy in Torino. And ultimately, he told me, he says, you know, Lydia, my dream is to have one in New York, in America. And I said, well, you know, this concept would go great in America. Let me talk to my boys, which is Mario and Joe, if they kind of feel up to it, because it's a big challenge. They loved it. And that's how the idea, and we brought it here. New York is 55,000 square feet of retail, Italian products, but also fresh local products. So, you know, because local fish, local vegetables and meats. And then there's 7 restaurants within that. So what's wonderful about that is that it is kind of 360 degree of food from basic, raw food, through cooking school. So every aspect of cooking that one would like is there. The 7 restaurant. But you know, Craig, what I think really was something that maybe we weren't planning was the social element of this 55,000 square feet. It really is a kind of social message. People come there. They feel like in Italy. They socialize. There's the piazza. There's the cafe. Or you can have a scoop of ice cream. Or you can taste, just have a little bit of prosciutto. And I think it's really Italianità. One really feels Italy in there. The products, the Italian products, 60% of the products that we have are not sold in the United States, because Italy collaborates with Slow Foods, with Petrini. And so Slow Food is all about these traditional producers of food in Italy, and now they're all over the world. But so we buy and bring and encourage these little producers to continue their traditional production of small productions, even, of whether it's colatura di alici or, you know, all of that, that, you know, it wasn't even known here. And I think that's what makes this a special destination, because, you know that when you go there, you'll find one of those products that will make your meal really Italian.
It's amazing. It's an amazing amazing establishment. We were at the one in Rome and watched, they were stretching mozzarella there. You had that Campania section, and there was a meat section and a seafood section. It was beyond.
Yeah, but you know, I think that in Italy it's great, it's fine, but the Italians see that.
They already know
that. To be able to transport all of that here, and we have a lot of support from Italy. I must say, Oscar, the mozzarella maker, the bread maker, all of that periodically come from Italy to ensure that the culture continues. Maybe in the Italian way.
Maybe they could stop by our place, make sure we're doing things right.
This is Bina, KALW series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is chef, restaurateur, and cookbook author Lydia Bastianich, whose book is Lydia's Mastering the Art of Italian Cuisine, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Great Italian Cook. She's joined in conversation by Delfina chef and co-owner Craig Stahl. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So what's next?
What's next?
So, you have a cookware line and six restaurants and cookbooks and TV shows and a production company and a retail emporium. What do you look forward to most when you
but
wake
Craig,
up in the morning?
Craig, you know, I'm sitting here. You're interviewing me, but it's not all about me. It's, you know, it's whether it's my children. It's all the great people that make the team, that have a vision, that want to go for. I couldn't have done all of this certainly by myself, and so it's a team. I might be the spirit. I might be the enthusiasm. I might have the stability, the roots. But there's a lot of other people involved, and I think as far as growth, I love communicating and mentoring, if you will. So certainly, you know, some television and some writing is what I love to do and kind of record it. I love connecting with the chefs. Go periodically. I take them to Italy. I know you do. I do that kind of mentoring young people into the business. So I think there's more of this in the future. Do I have a specific program? I'm going to open another three restaurants. No, you know, it's all up to the children and to the team where they want to go. If they take me, I'll be with them.
Fantastic. And I think it's time for audience questions.
Okay.
As a dedicated foodie, sometimes I ask people, what food memory from your childhood do you try to recapture? For me, it's grandma's potato salad. So for each of you, which memory from your food memory from your childhood do you try to recreate and can't quite grasp?
For me, there's quite a few because, you know, at that period when I was taken away and then I wanted to go back. But, there's and it's in the book, Swiss chard and potatoes is one of them. My grandmother used to make it, and I just loved it. Savoy cabbage and potatoes with polenta next to it. It's another one. Palacinque, which are the crepes with jam. Yeah, yeah. So you know, I could go on a few because, you know, that's my profile. That's, food is so deep. Yes.
Hi there. I just first want to say thank you so much. The things you write and the things you say, they remind my husband and I to slow down and appreciate our culture and our families and where we come from. My question for you comes from my experience of living in a small apartment in San Francisco with no outdoor garden space of my own. And I hear you talk tonight. I've heard you talk on your show about the importance of being connected to the earth and the importance of being connected to these ingredients and where they come from and cultivating them ourselves. Do you have any advice or insight living in an apartment in a city like this, in a foggy city? How can we be connected to the earth?
Well, I think here in San Francisco, you have so many opportunities. The market, a ferry market. I mean, when I come here, I just love going there. And those are your connection to the soil, those producers, go there, talk to them, understand it, and you will be connected. You can go and visit them. I'm sure they will if you want really that connection. But you go there and you buy their product and you support them. That's the best way that, you know, as a public, and I tell the public all the time, you know, yes, we should be eating better and all that. But, you know, you go to the store and then you buy the usual pre-packaged and whatever. You got to put your money where your mouth is, and that is that you've got to buy the right thing. You've got to encourage these farmers, animal husbandry, and all of this. You need to buy that. It might cost a little more. It might not, but the nutritional value and the flavor that you get from that investment goes much longer, and you ultimately need less of that product. As far as your little apartment, you can grow something on those windowsills, okay?
The next question's right here in the middle. Lydia, I grew up in an Italian-American restaurant family, and my grandmother started a restaurant in 1952. I would love to hear how your transition, how you got the people to transition from Italian-American and appreciating that to Italian-Italian, because that must have been something interesting in the 80s.
Well, I adore Italian-American food. I think it's part of history. It's part of the American history. It's part of the Italian immigrant adjusting in America. You know, you get to, you know, they came here. There's no traditional products, so they depended completely on technique.
Uncle and Ben's rice.
And whatever they could find. Yeah, exactly. Whatever they could find. I mean, just to give you one example, the Sunday sauce that is so known Italian-American. And in it, on Sunday sauce, it cooks for 3 hours. You put sausage, you put meatball, you put braciole. There's no such sauce in Italy. there is in Campania, you know, in which is the kind of the birthplace of this Sunday sauce. So when I wrote that book... Yeah.
Ragù napoletana, but
yeah,
it's...
Ragù napoletana. So when I wrote, I said to one of my friends, I said, take me to your mother. I'm going to go in her house. I want her to cook this Sunday sauce for me. She took this San Marzano tomatoes, a little bit of onions. She took a piece of raw pork and a piece of cotica. Cotica is the skin of the pork and whatever. And in an hour and a half, this was done. That was the Sunday ragù versus here. But, you know, the logic is that, you know, the tomatoes, even though the tomatoes are a new world product, the tomatoes that were here were the big tomatoes for salads, for so very juicy, a lot of acidity, so they had to cook it longer, put the sugar, you know, flavor it with lots of garlic. And, you know, as immigrants in Italy, one of the reasons they left, there wasn't enough food. There wasn't certainly no meat. Here they came, and they had the availability of meat. So, you know, to have meat meant live well. And so that Sunday sauce, they had all kinds of big meats. And this is an adaptation, an adjustment to what they found. Venerable cuisine, I love it. For me, it was a chance that we took in doing regional Italian cuisine in Felidia. But I had to be true to myself. I knew that it... because the food just warrants it. It's delicious. So it was a risk, but you know, I was too naive then to see it as a risk.
Thankfully,
and we just went into regional.
Lydia, as I watch you cooking on your TV show, you're always dressed in a lovely, vibrant, seems like silk blouse, and yet when you're finished, there are no spots on it.
You know, there's plenty of spots. The TV doesn't show it, although now with HD, you can see some. And so I'm just the same, you know, it squirts in whatever. But, you know, the custom designer, you know, you need brightness, you need light, you need to look nice. So I get dirty like everybody else. I do.
I think it's a very Italian thing, cooking that way. And
But in Italy, yeah.
Yes, I see that. Definitely.
Yeah. The women in the kitchen, they like to be. They even wear their jewelry.
It's something.
Yeah.
Hi. Yeah, I grew up Italian, Piemontese, Lago Maggiore, with five aunts. So Saturday night dinner and Sunday dinner. But everybody was, it was a lot of polenta and chicken, a lot of polenta and rabbit, a lot of polenta and pheasant, but it was the pot, the copper pot, that was so major. And we all, I mean, they just stood there but what was so good about the copper pot, we never understood. We fought over it when everybody passed away. But I just, they would just stir for a long time the polenta, and the copper pot was so important.
Well, copper diffuses heat evenly. So that's why it's like, you know, in cooking. So it's not that you get just a spot where the fire comes, but it travels up the pot itself. And polenta scorches easily. But not only the traditional polenta pot is rounded, it doesn't have the corners, because if polenta gets caught in the corners, it scorches evenly. So the copper was used because it, and a thicker copper, and because it conducts heat all the way up, so you didn't have to worry about it. The polenta would get cooked evenly. But for that matter, when you cook anything, it's important, you know, that you have a uniform heat. Otherwise, you have to control it, and copper does that.
You're obviously an amazing entrepreneur, and I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about switching hats between being a chef and cook and being a businesswoman.
Yes. Again, you know, it's about surrounding yourself with people. When you don't know something, you recognize you don't know, and then you need to go and look for answers. And but I had a sensibility. So let me go back where I credit my sensibility. My grandma, going back to grandma, we grew everything around and we ate. But when she had excess, we would go to the market once or twice a week. And with the hand cart, we would go. It was about 2 kilometers away. And the market, when you go to, now it's Pola, it used to be Pula, if any of you travel to Istria, it's still there. It's under those big chestnut trees. And you know, the women that had something to sell would come down with the cart, take a little table, and there was the scale, you know, never mind electronic scale, those scales with the little things, and you would borrow one, and I would help her sell. I would make out of newspaper, they're like a dunce hat, you know, you wrap it around your thing like a dunce hat, and that was the bag. And I used to make that, then I used to weigh things, and I used to, you know, she used to let me collect the money. And at the end of the day, I would get money to buy myself an ice cream. So I was a little merchant then, I guess. but it's surrounding yourself with the right people. And another thing I think that really drives me, I knew that, you know, I wanted to share. And unless you have a solid platform, and in America, but for that matter, or all over the world, is, you know, economics defines you as a winner or not. If financially you're viable and you do well, then you're a good businessman. But also it gives you a platform. People will listen more readily. You see, you gave me a platform. But people will listen more readily to you. And so, you know, all of these things, I think, were driving me. And also another thing, I think that, you know, when we were first as immigrants, I heard many a time my mother and my father, you know, they would whisper and whatever, but, you know, small apartment, we would hear. And they asked themselves a lot of times, one asked the other, did we do the right thing? Maybe we should have stayed home. Is this, what are we going to do here? And so, you know, I think that I wanted to prove to them that they did the right thing. I wanted to, you know, even now sometimes my mother, 95, she says, gee, you know, how blessed I am, all this success. And I says, Ma, you were at the basis of this. This would have never happened without you. And so I think all of these things put together drives people to do what they do, you know, whatever they have in them. But I think those are the elements.
Hi, I've cooked out of a lot of your cookbooks, and all of the recipes turn out very, very well. And I was wondering how you go about developing the recipes, especially for regions that aren't Istria.
Well, I do a lot of research. I do go to Italy 3, 4, 5 times, and I mean, I always have, and it's absolutely necessary, and I'm Italian, and that's why I really feel sometimes for young chefs that cook Italian and whatever, you know, it's not easy to understand a culture and be able to transport it. So do diligent research, absolutely. I test my recipes repeatedly. I've done most of them, and I test them myself. I test them when I write them. Then I retest them with my daughter and another rice. As I'm cooking, they're making all the notes. So I'm very, very diligent about it because I feel very responsible. And I want you to really get them and make those recipes. And I simplify. I simplify, you know. If I go and cook in a restaurant, I magnify because there I need to offer you something special, some things that you do not feel like doing at home and whatever. But if I want you to take you in your kitchen, I want you to cook, I can simplify and still concentrate flavors. I think that's my expertise of 40 years. The little things that I tell you to do will add flavor to that recipe and still remain simple. You know, as a professional chef for 40 years, I look how to diminish the ingredients in recipes. Sometimes you just can't. But I'm conscious of all of those things when I write my books and put recipes in there. And, you know, I hear that continuously, and, you know, and I feel very responsible that the recipes do really work well. So I'm pleased to hear that.
Hi there. Thank you for coming. I love Botarga. And one day I was at the foot of the Spanish Steps and I found a whole store loaded with different colors of Botarga. So I was choosing it and I made my purchase. And I went up the street to this little place and I had this wonderful salad, puntarella, in a glass bowl, a huge mound of it, in a simple vinaigrette. And then he said, oh, you could have anchovies with it. I said, yes, yes. And I wanted to know, do you know when puntarella is grown here? Because I've looked all over for it. I can't find it.
So puntarella is a chicory. It's a family of a chicory. And it looks almost like a root, like an artichoke, but it has then the long leaves. And so on this bulb that is
white, but core.
It's like a core. It's like a kohlrabi kind of look. Yeah. But it is chicory, and you break these little kind of shoots, and you cut them thin, and you put them in ice water, and they kind of get really nice and crunchy. And then you do make a dressing with oil, vinegar, and anchovies. You kind of crush it up in some garlic. And it's really very simple. It's very Roman. But it's a delicious, delicious salad. And you were mentioning Botarga. Botarga is the dried egg roe. And it's different colors because it's from different fish. And it has that intensity of fish which you seem to like anchovies.
Puntarella is available at the farmer's market. You should be able to, the ferry building. Ask Star Out. Ask Annabelle at Star Out Farms.
So, Craig and Lydia, the dream team, really, such a great evening. Thank you all. Have a wonderful evening. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was chef, restaurateur, and cookbook author Lydia Bastianich, whose book is Lydia's Mastering the Art of Italian Cuisine, Everything You Need to Know to Be a Great Italian Cook. She was joined in conversation by Delfina chef and co-owner Craig Stahl. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.